Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home, office, and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2, owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922 with residential and business internet, phone, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Mother Bear's Pizza of Bloomington, open daily and offering gourmet pizzas, hot submarine sandwiches, and salads with daily specials. Menu available online at motherbearspizza.com. 332-4495 for delivery.
Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times in Bloomington, along with co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael. And today we're going to talk about higher education with two very distinguished guests that we have with us here in the studio. Joining us are Indiana State University President Daniel Bradley and DePaul University President Brian Casey. You can join us on the program by phoning 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. You can also join the discussion by going to our website, wfiu.org/noonedition. And presidents, welcome.
Thank
Two
you.
Presidents at once.
I think we're going to have to go with first names. If we say Mr. President, nobody's going to know how to answer.
That's right.
Well, I hope you won't be offended by that.
No.
All right. This is a first for us. We've had presidents of Indiana University, and we should actually – I should probably mention the passing of Miles Brand. Mm-hmm. Miles was on our program. Mm-hmm. He did he was on, I think, more than once. He would always do a show where we didn't take call-ins. He was more comfortable. I think a lot of the obituaries and a lot of the things have been written about Miles talk about how he was sort of a shy man, and mm-hmm. he truly mm-hmm. was. Who did a lot of really good things for Indiana University.
With Peg on the show as well.
His wife Peg. So we give our condolences to the Brand family. But we've never had a president from Indiana State or from DePaul on the program.
Wow. Glad for the change.
Yeah, so we're happy to have you. Now, President Bradley, you told me before the show you started July 31st, 2008. So you've been here for just a little bit longer than a year. Would you give us just sort of a nutshell description of your background, your bio?
Sure. I started out my academic career as a chemist at Montana Tech, which is a part of the University of Montana. Did that for a few years and then became a petroleum engineer and taught petroleum engineering for most of my academic career. Went through the normal stages of department chair and dean and vice chancellor for academic affairs. And then 9 years ago now, I left Montana and became president at Fairmont State University in West Virginia. And then just over a year ago, came to Indiana State.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you here in the Hoosier State.
Thank you.
And President Casey, I know that you've spent some time in Indiana earlier.
Yeah, this is my second go-around. I was an undergraduate at Notre Dame. A long time ago, how we'll leave it at that, now in the early 80s. But whereas Dan had, I'd like to think, a classic route to the presidency, I had a much more tawdry travel to it. I was a lawyer on Wall Street for several years before I went back and –
Well, it doesn't get much more tawdry than that.
And I'm still trying to recover from that. No, I in a dramatic move, I quit that and went up and got a doctorate in history and was pursuing that route. And then suddenly in a very early turn of my career was called into what was supposed to be a one-year position helping the administration out at Brown University where I was at the time. I was promised it was just be a one-year thing, and it's been – multiple years later, I was at Brown for a while, and then right before I came to DePaul, I was a dean for academic affairs at Harvard University. So I arrived about a year ago back in Indiana.
Well, we're glad to have you back.
Thank
as
you.
Well. Well, I thought I'd start the program with just asking for some priorities from each one of you, and let's start with Dan, if I may, priorities at Indiana State.
Well, I think our biggest priority is to help our students be more successful. You know, there's been a lot in the press about success rates in college, particularly in public universities. And so that's definitely our biggest priority going forward. We're in the midst of a strategic planning process right now that we'll finish up here in the next month that has basically six prongs to it. But but student success, both in getting into college and then staying to completion, is going to be the major thrust of what we do.
So getting in and staying through completion is how you define success. I mean, it's really a fairly reasonable debate that people have. You know, is just graduating success, or is then gainful employment, does that equal success?
I think that's a good question. And some people would say on the alternative side to that is the students decide whether they're successful. So if they stay a year and decide that's all they want and they've decided that that's success, who are we to argue? I think operationally we're going to define it as graduate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. And Brian?
Well, it's interesting. I think every president has to come up and say we're in a strategic planning process as well. But we are actually looking at our own core mission. It's interesting to, you know, essentially at its core, DePaul University is a kind of a classic liberal arts college. We're a university because we have a school of music that very noble and old. It's celebrating its 125th anniversary this weekend coming up. But in this day and age, to explain to a public what a private liberal arts college is and what it does, and In some ways, we don't have an instrumentalist sort of explanation for what we do, because in some ways you say, you know, taking a lot of courses in which you read Macbeth might not lead you to a job at Goldman Sachs, but is intrinsically valuable. So in some ways, you know, we have a very expensive product, and we are telling students that we're going to transform them through kind of a classic liberal arts curriculum. So explaining in this world, and particularly in these financial times, what exactly it is that our school does at a scale that we do it at is, you know, it's a challenge on the admissions front. It's a challenge on the financing front. And, you know, to add to it, and I'm sure Dan will agree with me on this, all institutions right now are facing considerable financial pressures as all our sort of standard revenue sources got hit very, very hard. And both of us took a bit of a hit from the state in its support of its in-state students. We really had a hard go of that this summer, and I'm sure you did as well.
Right.
Well, I think it's interesting that both your universities are different kinds of schools. I mean, a private university in Greencastle and a public university in Terre Haute. You're not very far apart, but I'm sure that you're competing for some of the same students, I would assume, but also there are different kinds of students that are going to choose DePaul over Indiana State and vice versa.
Right.
But I wanted to follow up with you, Brian, because I have, as I told both of you, I've been talking to people on both your campuses. So I know that you've been talking a great deal about intellectual life and the idea of trying to sort of find the balance between, you know, some common experiences for students, trying to build places where the students learn from each other and don't just learn in the classroom.
Right.
How's that working? What can you sort of explain a little bit more about that goal?
It's funny. The very first speech I gave to the whole faculty is I said that, you know, institutions rise and fall on the strength of their intellectual life, the depth and the appeal of what happens intellectually on a campus. And that's very hard to define. I mean, one way you measure it is, you know, what happens in the classroom? What's your curriculum like? But more importantly, what's your ethos? Is it a place that supports and supports intellectual play and supports intellectual discovery? And how do you measure that? How do you do that? What I'd grown concerned with over the years, and this picks up something that I started with, is that DePaul was starting to model itself on, you know, Indiana State and IU, and starting to build in kind of quasi pre-professional programs. We have management fellows, we have media fellows, we have these movements toward a kind of a pre-professional posture. And I was worried, are we moving away from that kind of classic liberal arts, almost indefensible, you know, mom and dad, I'm taking another course on Kafka sort of positioning, you know. But how do we promote the sense of discovery and exploration on the campus, both in the classroom and outside of it? So our faculty has had a long, hard year of looking at intellectual life, trying to define it. And we had a very, very interesting meeting on Monday in which the faculty just voted after a very heated and quite emotional discussion, a new vision for the institution. So
we'll hear more about that.
Yes, you will.
I think I talked to my source before that meeting. Maybe I should have talked to him afterwards.
Who are your sources?
No, I can't divulge those, of course. Dan, Indiana State has a little bit different mission, I guess, although – a lot of it sounds the same. I mean, any university is going to want to sort of enhance the experience of its students by more than just going into a classroom. So what kinds of things are you doing at ISU for
that? Well, I think that that's one of the ways we think that we can enhance student success is that there's really a lack of engagement with the institution that goes on, particularly with freshmen. And so that's a large part of our effort. We've had a long-term commitment to community engagement and experiential learning, but we're trying to go beyond that and really get our students involved the kids who want to go home every weekend, those are the ones we're really trying to work on, to get them so that they're 24-hour-a-day Indiana State students. I think it's a bigger challenge at a public institution than it is, say, at many liberal arts colleges, where you're isolated, you're relatively small, and the students have they've had a better experience with education in the past, and so they're more dedicated to that intellectual goals associated with school. Mm-hmm. But engagement is the mantra.
Ownership really is that.
Yeah, I think we want the employees to have ownership, feel a need to interfere with the students' lives outside of the classroom and be interested in the students' lives out of the classroom. We want our students to be interested in each other's lives outside of the classroom. So that they become part of the community. We have too many students who have not made the intellectual commitment to getting a degree, to being students. In the simplest sense, they might value their part-time job at McDonald's more than they value their relationship with the university. Mm-hmm. And it's easy for people to get into that mode, and it's not. But that's our task, is to break people out of that so that they remember the part-time job is to help them stay in school, not the other way around. Well,
go ahead.
I just wondered, what role does research play in each of your universities?
Well, I think it depends on the program. I mean, all of our faculty are required both by administrative requirements and by faculty governance rules to be involved in research. We do a modest amount. It varies dramatically in terms of funded research. We do a modest amount, but it varies dramatically from program to program. In our biology department, we have PhD programs, and so the research requirements there would be different than, say, in another department that only has baccalaureate programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question to ask of the liberal arts colleges right now, because I think it's a completely false or dated notion that the faculty at liberal arts colleges are not engaged in research, and that they're all some variation of Mr. Chips. They're just the teachers, and our faculty are unbelievably committed to teaching. But the way that all faculties now are developed scholars come out. We're hiring our faculty from leading research universities. They get their doctorates, so they're trained as researchers, and they are fully invested in the notion that their research informs their teaching. And those are always hard to quantify. So institutionally, we certainly have a much, much smaller footprint in federally funded research. We'll have modest NSF financing, modest Department of Energy financing. But most of our research is, it's of a smaller scale. A lot of it's self-funded. The institution supports faculty development. But that particular tension a liberal arts college about, you know, what commitment to research and how does this redound to the students in the classroom ends up being – it's a fairly emotional topic mm-hmm. on our campus. And you hear a lot of alums come back and they get concerned. You know, they can feel the interest of the faculty in research. And they're concerned because they think, oh, that's pulling them away from the classroom. And I remember the great teachers I had. And is the culture somehow shifted in ways that violates their memories? Mm-hmm. And that's – I think that's the power of nostalgia in a lot of ways. very powerful force on a campus. But, you know, it's kind of a perpetual debate on our campus, and I don't think we're going to resolve it in the next, say, 45 minutes here. But it's an interesting point to bring up.
You actually did your dissertation on nostalgia.
I sure did. I campus is always my theory is that it's on a campus for a whole series of cultural reasons. There's always an imagined or wished for past that everyone clings to. That actually, because it is not real, it can never be fully refuted. Mm-hmm. so you have to manage it, and actually, quite frankly, you can use it as well. It's also a doorway back for your alums to come back. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in the nostalgia business in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think about, you know, when we were talking about you know, the experience on a campus and trying to get your students engaged at Indiana State. I think, you know, I turned into one of those old guys, I guess, who thinks, if I had known now what the opportunities were that were available to me when I was an undergraduate at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, I would have probably done some things differently than I did. You know, I think I turned out okay, but wow, it would have been so much fun to participate in all these things that were going on around me. Instead, I was, you know, off drinking beer at the bar or something.
Which was also fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Well, I mean, and I'm nostalgic about that.
There you go. Well, do you regret intellectual opportunities that you passed up, or do you regret?
Yeah, I think I do. I think I definitely regret some intellectual opportunities I passed up. You know, like I remember, since we're chatting, I remember a fine arts class that I wish I would have been more engaged in instead of just taking a pass-fail and going when I felt like it.
You know, it's interesting. We had admitted students weekend for, you know, once their students were admitted, we were trying to convince them to come to DePaul. And we had a series of conversations with parents, and we talked about this, you know, these wonderful courses you can take. Inevitably, the parents come up and say, oh my, you know, I'm 47. I really want to come back and take film studies, or I really wish I'd take another Shakespeare course. And, you know, then they look at their 17-year-old sitting next to them who's all trying to pretend their parents aren't sitting next to them.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the kids are like, don't talk about Shakespeare anymore, Mom. Okay, just don't do that.
So. We do it all wrong. We should all have to work for 25 years and then get to go to college as a reward.
Well, I can, you know, right. Dan and I have never left, so.
Right.
Right.
I do want to go back to Indiana State's, you know, as a public institution, you know, there are a lot of pressures on you, I would think, from the state in terms of – you were talking about funding before.
Right.
And there are a lot of Hoosiers who believe that the mission of the university should be get my kid to go there, train them to do something, set them off in the world so that they can actually have a job and make money. And the universities are so much larger than that. So how do you sort of balance that notion that you should be turning out graduates who go straight to work as opposed to this idea of, you know, intellectual pursuit while people are on a campus?
Well, I think, you know, we offer a very wide array of degree programs. And some of them have a fairly extensive professional preparation component, and that's basically the trade-off. We've got this professional preparation component. We've got a general studies component, and you know that's the tug of war that goes on the campus is how much is enough, and goes on actually within the accreditation groups as well.
And within the family.
Within the family, that's right. I mean, there are, as Brian was saying before we started, there are plenty of people with liberal arts educations who have taken up leadership roles in very technical companies, doing basically anything. What we give them in many ways is what gets people in the door. And, you know, 5 years later, They better be able to bring more to the table than those mm-hmm. those initial skills that we gave them. Mm-hmm. So that's what, in many measures, that's what the general ed, the general studies program has to be the underpinning is, because that's what can help you survive the last 25 right. years or 30 mm-hmm. years of your career.
Well, what are you finding are the disciplines that young students are sort of gravitating toward today, and how has that changed over time?
I think, you know, when I started college in the late 60s, you know, history and political science and psychology and English mm-hmm. probably dominated mm-hmm. almost every institution, public or private. You know, business, education, criminology are much more likely to be the dominant programs on a public comprehensive institution these days. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see. I mean, we have a number of students in liberal arts programs, but far more in professional programs. Nursing is a big program. So mm-hmm. students and their parents, many of them are looking for professional preparation at the bachelor's degree level.
Mm-hmm. How about at DePaul? Do you find any different areas that people are very interested in?
Well, I think DePaul experienced the same phenomenon that you saw at a lot of our peer institutions, which was at first there was a significant movement toward the social sciences, quite particularly into economics. And our economics program is both economics and management, but most economics departments actually aren't business programs. It's a rather different thing mm-hmm. to study economics, but there was a significant flight toward economics. What we're also seeing is a strong shift toward the biological sciences with our students. You know, I think originally by an interest in pre-medical positioning, but also, I mean, the biology is exploding. Biology is changing. What I studied as an undergraduate, biology actually isn't biology anymore. So, but you see a significant move toward those fields, and you know, and I think at DePaul and a lot of other places, you can feel the humanities trying to offer some sort of defense of their relevance, and there's been a lot of articles recently about what relevance to humanities, and one of DePaul's responsibilities is to offer a firm defense of the humanities as part of the mix. So mm-hmm. we'll see where this keeps going.
Right. I should mention I quoted Miles Brandon in an editorial I did when he left Indiana University. He said he felt like the health sciences would be mm-hmm. to the 21st century what the physical sciences were right after World War II and in the latter part of the 20th century.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that came to mind when you were speaking. So,
and you know, there's huge demand in the healthcare areas for employees as well, and so I think that's in some ways driving that interest in the biological sciences mm-hmm. in terms of career preparation, because most of those programs are, or many of them are at the graduate level. Mm-hmm. At least in our institution.
Mm-hmm. All right. I think we'll take our midway break now. We're starting to get emails come in, and I would imagine that if I introduce you guys again, because I've been kind of remiss in doing that, we might get some phone calls too. But we're talking with Indiana State University President Daniel Bradley and DePaul University President Brian Casey. You're listening to Noon Edition. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, Smithville telephone information at smithville.net, and from Mother Bears Pizza at motherbearspizza.com. You can take WFIU programs with you by downloading our podcasts. Podcasting is a convenient and easy way to download audio files directly to your computer, iPod, or portable player. You can download podcasts of full-length programs like Noon Edition, Ask the Mayor, and Harmonia, or short features like Kinsey Confidential, the Ether Game musical mini-quiz, as well as movie, play, and opera reviews. Find out more by going to our website, WFIU.org. And have you heard WFIU's news features? On Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, the WFIU news team brings you expanded and in-depth reports on topics affecting South Central Indiana. Listen at 8:33 a.m. and 5:45 p.m. every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to catch that day's feature. If you miss one, that's okay. They're archived on our website, WFIU.org, and the best features from each week can be heard Saturday mornings at 7:45.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Salzberg from the Herald Times, along with co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael. And today we're talking about higher education with two guests in the studio, two very distinguished guests, Indiana State University President Daniel Bradley and DePaul University President Brian Casey. You can join us on the show by calling 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. That's if you're in Greencastle or Terre Haute. And you can also join the discussion on our website, wfiu.org/noonedition.
We've had a couple of emails that have come in, and this first one is a two-parter, so I think I'm going to go ahead and break it up. It begins, if you were about to start college, what are the majors that would help you with job placement after graduation? Interesting follow-up on our recent conversation here.
Well, I think that's a pretty broad statement. I think the first thing a person has to do is do some interest inventory analysis as to what kind of a job does a person want. You know, indoors, outdoors, quantitative, qualitative, high communications, low communications needs.
High pay, low pay.
Well, high pay, low pay. Do you want to live in Terre Haute or do you want to live in Chicago? Those are the kinds of things that people have to look at if they want to go into this in a search mode of trying to find out what kind of a career they want. So just look at where the jobs are today is probably a big mistake because jobs shift. And so you really need to make an effort to decide what you would like to do. And if that doesn't work out, then try something else. I think that's my recommendation.
I want to echo, especially your last point. Jobs shift so much. I mean, when I graduated from Notre Dame in 1985 and computer science was just emerging. Your ability to predict jobs over the long term is so irregular and going to be wrong. So I would build on the find what you not only like but what you love. I really believe that's deeply important. And because if you find an area that you love, if you look at a discipline as simply a critical lens in which you bring to the world, at least have some passion behind it. And if that's the way you're going to find out, you're going to develop into being a critical and independent thinker, and that's what you need to survive in a world in which you're probably going to change jobs, you know, a dozen times over the course of your life. So,
my own follow-up to this, and it's not from the emailer, is how well do you think our high schools are preparing students when you get them, by the time you get them, how well prepared are they to think in terms of, gosh, you know, what do I want to do here?
They're probably doing as well as they can be expected to do. I think my 30 years of working with adolescents, you know, teenagers, is that they're not real interested in many of them in making commitment. And so they keep their powder pretty dry in terms of talking to people and being willing to be introspective about these kinds of issues. That's not to say that there aren't lots of young people who know from age six that they want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse or a teacher, but many, many of them really struggle with a willingness to be introspective and think about it. And I think in many cases it takes that first year in college away from parents and away from home to really come to a decision.
If I had to look at a concern that we have on our campus – and this is – you said earlier, Bob, that you're an old man. I'm going to sound like such an old man here in that the skill that I most worry about its degradation over the last, you know, perhaps – two decades is just the basic capacity to write, write critically. And, you know, our kids that are coming to us with, you know, they're so media saturated, but at some level, breaking down a problem by writing your way through it is something that I'm not sure that they have a strong facility for anymore. So we find ourselves expending enormous amount of resources in writing because it's a mode of inquiry that I worry is not celebrated in our school systems or perhaps we haven't learned how to teach these sorts of young people how to write. And so you know, critical expression, both rhetorically and but most importantly, and there'll be faculty who won't like this, but most importantly by writing is something that I deeply worry about. And I could add into, you know, if any of my faculty are listening, scientific literacy is something that, you know, there you go. Okay, folks.
Don't email him. Okay, here's the second part of the same question is, with rising tuitions, how can students pay for college?
I think that again varies a lot from student to student. You know, students of modest means, there are a large number of both state and federal programs to help them. I think every institution has some level of need-based aid as well as merit-based aid, as well as jobs on campus and jobs in the community. And to fill in the gap, there are student loans. But it is getting harder, and I think that you're going to see a trend at moderating increases in tuition as a result to make sure that we don't price people out of the marketplace.
Yeah, I would. You know, we have similar financial models, but different as well. In that. Both of us, the actual product that we produce, the totality of the experience that these students have at both ISU and at DePauw, is quite expensive. I mean, these are incredibly expensive enterprises. These students are moving about a campus that represents decades and decades of capital investment. Faculty are They're very expensive employees, appropriately enough. But we have relied over the years on our endowment and the support of our alumni essentially to make up the gap between what we think we can charge students and what it actually costs. Mm-hmm. That model is under serious pressure. And if you look at, you know, the merit funding that we provide, that might be the beginnings of some pretty significant market corrections. You know, I'm sure Dan is the same thing. You're constantly modeling out your budget over multiple years. You know, if you keep increasing your tuition at 4% and 5%, or you know, or above inflation, you know, you're going to look at $75,000 a year awfully quick, mm-hmm. and that's a moment that you have to say to yourself, you know, what's going on here? What's the model? It's going to be a crisis, or it certainly is a crisis right now, and so. What is our investment? What's the nation's mm-hmm. interest in this situation right now? And the interest is high.
There are a lot of parents right now who are very glad to hear that projection is being made because it feels like a reality to a lot of people already.
Just if you look at higher education over a 25-year period, mm-hmm. we've exceeded the consumer price index right. for every year for multiple years. And I don't think that is – it's not financially sustainable and it's not culturally sustainable.
Yeah. And Mary Catherine's saving for Dylan's education now, so she'll be happy to hear that. All right, we have a couple phone calls and we have more emails, so let's go to Valerie on the phone first. Valerie?
Hi. I'm a proud parent of a 2009 DePauw graduate who
All
had
right.
merit
Woo-hoo.
Scholarships.
All right.
She's now a proud Teach for America teacher in Indianapolis, and what a wonderful education she had.
Oh, that's terrific.
But my question today is for Dr. Bradley, and that is, as a public institution, I'm wondering what percentage of your budget comes from the state, how many trustee appointments the governor has, and should it be proportional?
Before I forget it, proportional to what?
To what the state is giving you.
Oh,
right now
okay.
it seems like the governor has many more appointments to public institution trustees.
Our budget is approximately 50-50 in terms of tuition and state funding. But the 50% coming from tuition is a rising number, and the 50% coming from state appropriation is a dropping number. And to a large measure over the last 20 years, most of our super inflationary tuition increases could be traced to that fact that the state appropriation has not kept up with inflation.
Mm-hmm.
As far as our board, we have 9 members on the board. The governor actually appoints all of them, but two of them are based on recommendations from our alumni association and one from our student government association. So there are six that the governor has a free hand in, and three that he has a great deal of advice as to who should be there.
And are you happy with that ratio?
Well, I'm very happy with my board, and I hope they're all listening. I think that we have a long history in Indiana of boards of trustees at the public institutions, and I think that history and culture has resulted generally, at Indiana State anyway, in good board members. That's not always the case. I think in some states they've had a great deal of trouble where you get, for lack of a better word, political hacks on public higher ed boards because of money to the governor or whatever. That I don't think that has been the case in Indiana. So I'm quite happy today with how my board has been chosen, and I assume that the culture will make sure that that's preserved in the future.
All right, Valerie. Thanks a lot for the call. And we lost our second caller, so we can go back to your email.
Okay. This is a little change of pace from what we've been discussing, but it begins, the physical plant staff personnel at Indiana State and DePauw have been longtime partners with Indiana University in their efforts to avoid the price peaks of the natural gas market through smart hedging. Are there any new challenges that the administrators at the three campuses are jointly working together on to control costs or to improve the educational services we offer?
Yeah, we are certainly going to keep our eye on energy costs, but there hasn't been a lot of movement toward this. But I'd be curious to see whether we could, and maybe there'd be a public-private divide on this one. But the cost that actually keeps me up at night is healthcare costs. We provide healthcare coverage for, our faculty and our staff, and though the pressures on the pressure that puts on our budget is enormous, and it becomes a variable that's hard to predict, hard to manage, and if I think of any way I'd like to move forward, but now would be in some sort of collaboration on that. I mean, could we pool our resources or pool our activities in some other way? But I suspect that might be a public-private divide because of we operate in a little bit separate healthcare arenas.
I'm not sure that there would be any legislative barriers to us doing that, but I agree that healthcare costs are enormously driving our budget, just like utilities. You have no choice but to pay them. We've budgeted a 10% increase this year and a 10% increase next year, and it's about that comes down to about a 2.5% equivalent salary increase. So basically, our employees have given up about a 5% in their paycheck over the next 2 years because of health insurance costs.
Isn't that interesting? We're in such the scale of our enterprises are so different, but we have almost the exact same model. We have modeled in. We're assuming 10% increases in healthcare costs, and we're trying to find other contingencies. Can we set aside funds? And it is directly impacting our capacity to increase salaries. And I don't know how to exactly break that particular pattern, but we've come to the almost. I hope we haven't just violated some antitrust principle right now on radio. But that's exactly our assumptions.
Our guests today are Indiana State University President Daniel Bradley and DePauw University President Brian Casey. If you want to join us, please phone us at 855-0811 in Bloomington or 877-285-9348 outside of the Bloomington area. Or you can go to our website and email us, wfiu.org/noonedition.
Whenever Indiana University shows up on any kind of a rating scale, it always seems to be on the front page of his paper. So I wonder, how much attention do you pay to where you rank nationally by the various folks who get paid to do those sort of rankings? Is this something that you really pay close attention to?
Go ahead. Do you want the official answer?
I'd like both.
We're on the record here.
There you go. Officially and I think appropriately, there is much to decry about the U.S. News and World Report rankings. It's driven by reputational scores. It's still the most heavily weighted factor in the algorithm that determines rankings. And there's clearly an incentive for U.S. News to change that algorithm year after year. So there's movement in the rankings.
Otherwise, it's not interesting.
It's not interesting. You know, it's like, oh, look, Princeton's really good again. You know, so there's a little bit of a marketing games going on. So, you know, it is decried. It should be decried. But to say that we don't pay attention to it would be fully dishonest. Because we know that the effect this has on our students.
Mm-hmm. And recruitment.
It very, very much so. And, you know, you've seen various efforts. You know, Forbes has now come out with their own rankings. The Wall Street Journal had come up with its own rankings. There's been movement afoot for institutions themselves to develop their own ranking systems. You know, you live by them and you die by them.
I agree with everything Brian said. I think there are some that you know, we are, like I said, we're very involved with engagement and experiential education, and there are ratings that look at that in particular. And so we're very interested in how we stack up because we want to do well in that area, and we think that that can be measured. So it depends on the rankings. I think the more generic or more general the ranking, the less value it has. Mm-hmm. You know, our insurance and risk management program, for instance, has been rated very highly. And I think it's a small enough program and in terms of a piece of the university that it can be compared to someplace else. But when you try and compare Indiana State, for instance, we're in the national university grouping in U.S. News and World Report. Mm-hmm. Well, there is no way an institution in rural Indiana is going to be in the top tier of that group. Mm-hmm. So it's something you have to listen to and pay attention to, but you can't allow it to determine how you operate or where your goals are.
All right. We're going to go back to a phone call, and Rich is on the phone. Rich?
Hi, good afternoon.
Go right ahead.
I enjoyed the president's comments about the work of the boards of directors and the governance that those boards provide. I was curious about the relationship between governance by a board and recent events. I guess Senate Finance Committee held some hearings, or maybe it was Higher Education Committee. What's the relationship between a legislature and a governing board, and how do CEOs work with those two?
I guess that one's for me.
Certainly not for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm hired by the Board of Trustees for Indiana State University, and they are appointed by the governor. The committee that you're probably talking about is the Budget Committee. I don't report to that committee, but if they call me up and suggest I come and see them, you can bet that I'm going to be in the car. They control 50% of our budget and basically all of the capital construction on the campus. So their views are very important to us. They remind us that we are a publicly funded institution and need to keep the needs of the state and the citizens of the state high on our agenda. So while it's sometimes uncomfortable to be called into those meetings, it's a necessary part of the process, and I'm happy for the opportunity to present our positions.
All right, Rich. Thanks a lot for the call. We do appreciate it. All right, 855-811-877-285-9348 and WFIU.org/noonedition. I want to ask you, Dan, about Indiana State and teacher education, because, mm-hmm. of course, that's got a long history many decades ago as a teacher's college. And as I understand it, you've done some refurbishing of one of the halls and moved the School of Education.
We did. The School of Education moved into a new home a couple of weeks ago. It's kind of a real nostalgic event. The building that they've moved into was built in 1935 as our laboratory school and was known as University High School for 60 years. So we did funding from the state, did a total remodel of this building and really modernized it so we can really meet the needs of students today, but it really shows the character of buildings built in the 1930s. So it was a great event for the College of Education.
Does this signal any kind of a renewed emphasis in teacher training?
No, I don't think it – I hope not.
You're going to make a run on Ball State?
We think Ball State's running after us. I think teacher education has been a key program at Indiana State starting in 1865 and will be in 2065. We've got great programs in education. We think that pedagogy matters. And we think we do a very good job at both preparing teachers and administrators for our public schools.
All right. You want to address the some of the changes that are being proposed about pedagogy versus
Just in general. Uh-huh. I would say, you know, I'm a scientist and an engineer, and I went through a long period of my career where I felt that content was the only thing that mattered. And I would say that particularly in the last 10 years or so, I've come to the clear realization that I was very wrong, that content is important, but if you don't have the pedagogical skills to teach and to manage your classroom, your content is not going to matter at all because you're not going to get a chance to present it. Mm-hmm. So while I applaud efforts to improve the success rate of our students in public schools and to improve graduation rates, we need to spend a lot more time looking at other things than the content of the teachers. Maybe we should look at the school board structures and the superintendents and the principals and those kinds of things.
All right.
All right. We've had another email that's come in. Has either university set specific timelines and targets for reducing their carbon footprint? And if so, have you started budgeting for the facility upgrades that will be required?
I can we just passed a major anniversary on that. On September 15th of last year, I signed the president's campus climate commitment. And we had exactly 1 year to measure our carbon footprint. That's the first step that you mm-hmm. have to do. And it was due at 5 o'clock on September 15th of this year. And at 4 o'clock, we actually sent the email off. But it was interesting that the effort actually to understand and measure was a bit of a cultural shift because, we're not set up to actually make these measurements. But now the next step that we have to do is we have to start taking steps to not increase our carbon footprint. We're about to engage a campus planning firm because the campus has never developed a campus plan or a campus town plan. So we specifically hired a firm that was quite good at developing sustainability efforts. And, you know, I find myself spending time thinking about chillers and roofing systems. Yeah. I never knew roofs were systems, but they're systems now in which you capture rainwater. No, we're looking forward to it. And actually, you know what we're doing is we're actually catching up to our students' interest. We have a cadre of students. Cadre. Mm-hmm. We have a group of students who are so wound up about this, and it's the question of our time. Mm-hmm. So not only are we trying to address this institutionally as an operation, but it's infusing so many parts of our curriculum right now. And the students they're just bringing this energy to it. And we're sprinting to catch up with them right now.
We did have Carol Steele on with us several weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's leading the effort at DePaul. Right.
Yeah, that's great.
I think we signed the same agreement. We're probably one of the delinquents in that we haven't filed our report yet as far as I know. But We're in the process of preparing it. I think it's, you know, speaking practically, it's going to be very, very difficult for higher ed to do a lot in terms of changing itself without doing a lot of efforts in changing the world or changing Indiana, where we get something close to 90% of our energy, for mm-hmm. instance, from coal. Our campus is very interested. We're working on it. But it is a matter of what you can do, for instance, until we have alternatives to coal generated electricity and gasoline-powered cars.
Can you, will you be able to measure in any way? I mean, the efforts that you've been making to change the campus and to try to engage students and keep them from driving home every weekend and all those mm-hmm. things, is there any way to measure how those things are doing and whether, you know, you're making success environmentally by having more students not driving away every weekend and maybe not even driving outside of your campus area to other parts of Terre Haute?
Well, I think we can measure them. I mean, the first real data point we'll be looking at is what percentage of this year's freshman class return next fall. Now, we're in the process of developing intermediate measures so that we don't have to wait a whole year. But that we will be looking at all the kinds of things. You know, what kind of participation levels do we have in activities? What kinds of things are people seeing in the classroom? Mm-hmm. But we have to come up with more measures and ones that are more timely. I've told our residence life people that, you know, really in the first month, they are the key because they're the ones that see the students every single day, multiple times a day. And they've got to be the canaries telling us there's a problem in that first month, which is really the key to student success, the first month and ultimately the first semester. If students don't do well their first semester, very bad sign for the future.
What about enrollment numbers for each of your institutions? Are they going up?
We're up very modestly. We were on a very slow or shallow ramp down for a number of years, and we took a bump up. We'd like to grow some, but not dramatically.
Mm-hmm. We had an unbelievably unusual season last admission cycle because, you know, I'm sure Dan does the same. You know, you hire all these consultants who tell you exactly how every 17-year-old is going to behave and what emails you send to them that make them change their behaviors. But, you know, we had every prediction had that we would see reductions in our enrollments. We ended up seeing this explosion in our first year class. It was the largest first year class we've had in a long time, completely unpredicted, and that's putting significant pressure on our classroom experience. So, you know, who knows? It's such an inexact science. So we live and die by it, and here we are.
Mm-hmm. I know Indiana University had more students on campus this year than ever, even though the freshman class was down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's because of the retention issue that mm-hmm. you were talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, they can try to predict how many freshmen they're going to have, but then when all these students – they've succeeded and all these students stay, they just grow. All right. We are out of time. So I took the last 15 seconds for myself. I'm sorry about that.
It's okay.
I want to thank our guests today, Indiana State University President Daniel Bradley and DePaul University President Brian Casey. We certainly hope you'll both come back. That would be great.
Be happy to do that.
All right. For Mary Catherine Carmichael, producer Ariana Prothero, and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Salzberg. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.
Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home, office, and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2, owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922 with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. Mother Bear's Pizza of Bloomington, open daily and offering pizzas, pasta dinners, and wings with daily specials. Menu available online at motherbearspizza.com, 332-4495 for delivery.